service of each of the members, but I think it's I would be remiss not to point out the reappointment of Michael Bigham. Michael is a former police officer and brings a perspective that I'm sure most in the community find refreshingly honest and objective. He has oftentimes disagreed with the police bureau. And I personally appreciate the integrity that it takes for a person that served as a police officer to do that. So I haven't called you out before, Michael, in that observation. Thank you very much. And I'm really pleased that you're staying on to do the excellent, outstanding work that you do. And I appreciate each and every member. Thank you. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I want to thank Auditor Gary Blackmer for bringing forward a outstanding set of nominees, and Director Baptista for putting together a process that sounds very thorough and very extensive. But these are outstanding nominees you've brought to us, and I want to welcome Ms. Anderson and Ms. Silver aboard and congratulate once again Mr. Bigham and Ms. Robinson for staying on. They do great work. Aye.
Adams.
I want to thank you for your willingness to serve again and to serve for the first time. I also want to just note the tremendous gains that, under Auditor Blackmer's leadership, have been made by the Independent Police Review Division, and I especially like sort of the spirit of continuous improvement that he brings to the effort. So thank you. Aye. Council Item 59 is approved. That moves us, I believe, to Council Item 79.
Accept new maintenance policy due to economic downturn.
In the last, the leadership of the Portland Bureau of Transportation would come forward. In the last budget process, we budgeted, given the constrained resources that we have in transportation, we budgeted in a manner that today I'm asking Council to weigh in on, just to formalize sort of the budgetary policy we've already approved, to formalize the, to put policy and operational priorities behind that budget decisions we made last year. Transportation in the City of Portland remains one of its most challenged services in terms of the status of the asset condition, in terms of how safe the system is for those that use it almost every single day by every single person in the city. And we today are making the very difficult decision of triage. We need to be clear with ourselves and with the public what we are going to be doing in terms of asset management and what we will not be doing in terms of asset management. And I think I'll try to summarize in just a sentence that with approval of these two council items, we will be focused on the busiest streets in terms of maintenance and safety in the City of Portland. We will be doing calls for service when someone reports issues on the neighborhood streets. But the busiest streets for freight and transit is where from now on we're going to be doing most of our proactive work. And when someone calls for potholes or life safety issues on all the other streets, we will respond to them. Director Keel.
Thank you, Mayor. This is very difficult, but it's been a continuing process of death by small cuts. And this last year, we rapidly declined in revenue from the time we first came to you to ultimately needing to make a reduction of $5.5 million in the current year because of the precipitous decline in both gas tax and parking meter revenue. Parking meter revenue now represents about 30% of our revenue stream, and we're off about $1 million in the current year on that. So we've had to make reductions in expenditures, including personnel, in the current year. But significantly, as Mayor Adams said, when we were out talking to the community about this and the numerous meetings with our Budget Advisory Committee, they're very consistent in their advice to us that if you don't have enough resources, you need to devote them to those arterials and collectors that carry the transit that are the lifeline routes that connect the commercial areas of town, the places that folks need to go, and that if we have to allow something to decline further, it ought to be the residential streets and the right-of-way associated with those streets. So clearly, this is what the advice is that the people gave to us when we were out in numbers of meetings in the community. I don't remember exactly now, but it was a lot, 28 or so meetings. It was very consistent advice we received from the people. And our Budget Advisory Committee absolutely endorses it as well.
And that includes labor and outside stakeholders.
Absolutely. And we have talked this through our budget and our reductions. I want to say it's one of the, you don't want to say that any budget reduction process is wonderful, but working it through with our labor partners has been almost an inspirational experience. I mean, we're all aimed at the same objective and doing things for the right reason. And we've had to cut 15 positions. We have only one person bumping as a result of that because we've been able to accommodate them by placing them or making classification changes, worked with the Water Bureau on some of that as well. So we really have worked at not sending people out on the street who we didn't have any employees that were problem employees impacted by this. These were good folks, and we wanted to keep them in jobs doing work for the public. So it's been a tough process, but I think a very good process, and I think everybody, virtually everyone that we have talked to, believes that this strategy is the right one.
John, do you have anything to add?
No.
Any questions from council?
I guess I want to make clear, you will still respond to potholes on residents?
Absolutely.
Okay, so
boy, are we responding to potholes.
We have a pothole hotline, right?
But we do. 823-BUMP.
823-BUMP,
right. It's running.
Why
I noticed
it?
I was watching.
823-DROP.
A drop, yeah. I noticed across the bottom of the screen on a football game the other day that this 823-BUMP was running, and I don't know what the current number is, but we're getting about 59 reports a day. So folks seem to have that number.
Good, because I think there's a lot of people out there that think you have to know somebody in City Hall to get a pothole replaced. And so,
trust me,
I always tell them, call 823-BUMP.
And yep. That, and our crews are also identifying themselves as they're out doing other work. So you may get those on the hotline, but we have a whole body of other ones we're repairing in addition to that.
So. Sue, could I ask a question? Obviously, the winter storm caused substantial havoc to our system, and I live in the Grant Park area of Northeast.
And you have a pothole, right?
No, I'm not here to report a pothole.
Sure.
But obviously the roads were greatly affected and deteriorated, including some of the areas that you recently paved, and that we were grateful for that. Just in terms of aggregate estimate, how much damage was done to our roads? We know we have a substantial backlog, but have you been able to quantify on any level what that storm cost us in terms of future repairs?
I don't think so. John, have you heard anything?
John Riss, Bureau of Transportation. I don't think we have that, Commissioner.
I mean, we
know what the storm cost, but I think your question
there is one silver lining in parts of where I live, which is people are slowing down.
That's right. It's the poor man's traffic calming.
It does have that, unless you want to spend, you know, extra time at Midas Les Schwab, you slow down in my neighborhood, which is probably a good thing, particularly since I'm in the process of teaching my daughter how to drive, which is why I've grown a little grayer.
Well, the freezing and the rain after that and caused more deterioration in streets. And what may be classed as a pothole, we've done this with Commissioner Adams went out and took pictures of our potholes that we weren't repairing. Not everything that you think is a pothole is a pothole, and it may be a sign of further deterioration. It may be a bigger problem. It may be much worse than what you're seeing because you may get that on the surface as a result of something below the surface that is in worse shape. So we can try to make an estimate on that with our new paving management system. We're going to have a rating on all of the streets in the city, and it'll help us prioritize where our expenditures need to go with the reduced resources and if we get additional resources. So we have some good, solid information to help us.
Other questions or comments? Commissioner Fritz.
I respect your process in clearly providing the limited resources to our current facilities is cost-effective and letting them deteriorate further, and then it's more expensive to completely redo them. It does, however, tend to direct the resources to the areas that already have paved streets, and I'm wondering what our process is for identifying in areas like East Portland, Outer Southwest, other areas of town with a lot of arterial streets which are not up to city standards. What's our process for prioritizing our capital improvements?
Well, we, as I said, this pavement management system on streets that have been accepted into the city. Now, there were streets that we received through annexation that didn't meet the standard.
157 miles.
Yeah. And so those may not be, A, our responsibility in some cases where you think about them, or B, may not, did we accept any arterials in, Sam, that were not?
We did. We've made some improvements there, about 157 miles of unimproved streets. Some of them have blacktop onto them, some are gravel, some are just in really bad shape. What we've talked about is the possibility of doing a gravel, like we're contemplating leaf districts. The idea is there's some way, well, first off, make it really inexpensive for folks that live on unimproved streets to improve them themselves so that they don't have to go through all the fol-de-rol of the city having to do it. And so that's our first priority. For those streets that we can't get to, how do we make it really, really easy and inexpensive for people to get together voluntarily with their neighbors and do it themselves? And I hope to have something back to council within the next 60 days on that as part of the budget process.
I would just add, Commissioner Fritz, that our capital improvement program is primarily financed with revenue from outside sources, whether it be state, federal dollars, PDC dollars, SDC, system development charges that developers pay. So we have very limited general transportation revenues into our capital program. Where it's focused is primarily on the maintenance side, and this is the second year in a row that we've had to totally eliminate our contract paving program with outside contractors, and that's where we get the very large arterial projects that are above state law and above the capacity of what our current crews can do. So that has been about $3.4 million that we've had to reduce over the last 2 years of major paving projects in the city.
But there's a difference between the arterial and the local street on this. So, I mean, I will go back and check and see if we have any substandard arterials in the system.
I think Commissioner Fritch is just referring to within the city limits is that 157 miles of what we call unimproved.
And so maybe that's a different conversation,
yeah.
Including with development services. I was just recently out on 136th in Powell House,
right.
Gilbert, where we've got hundreds of new homes being built and no sidewalks and a substandard street. So I recognize that's a different conversation. I just wanted to acknowledge that we are continuing to pursue,
yep,
improving those streets so that in future years when we're looking about maintaining, there'll be more equity in the different areas of the city.
And interestingly, when then Commissioner Adams and I were talking about what I wanted to have as a priority in the package that he was working on a year or so ago, I identified 136th Avenue as exactly, mm-hmm, the street that needed the sidewalks. So I appreciate you, although I never got a notice that you passed 82nd. I thought that was our agreement. Anybody on the council goes past, he's 82nd, has to call me first.
No, I was planting trees at your water bureau.
Okay.
If we need to provide some specific information about a street, let us know.
Thank you.
Other questions from council? Thank you. Who signed up? How many have we signed up to testify?
No one signed up for this item.
Okay. Can we go ahead and, okay, anybody here wishes to testify that did not sign up? Okay. Carl, will you please call the roll on item 79?
Fish?
So we're voting to adopt the report and then we're moving to the resolution?
Correct.
Aye.
Fritz.
Fritz.
So you want me to hold comments till the next one?
Probably. Yeah.
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Companion item 80, would you please read the title?
Adopt the new Bureau of Transportation policy, direction of reduction of services on local streets.
Has anyone signed up to testify? Anyone here wishes to testify on the transportation policy, direction of reduction of services on local streets? All right, please call the roll.
Fish.
I just want to acknowledge Sue Keel's leadership. When I got sworn in June of last year, one of the first meetings I had on my calendar was a meeting with Director Keel, and I walk into the Rose Room or something, and there's 100 people at the table with their names, and I got my first briefing on the full scope of what she does, and I, an hour and a half later, my head was spinning. I think I realized then and have realized since that her job is just a monumental challenge, and we don't have the resources to meet the needs, so we're constantly doing triage, and yet our fragile system works. And I just want to say, as someone who is not the transportation commissioner but is especially interested in the key decisions that you and the leadership team make, that I appreciate the way that you interact with this council, and I appreciate the creative way that you've been dealing with our budget crisis. I think we probably all have something to learn from the way your bureau is weathering this storm. Please to vote aye.
Fritz?
I agree with that. When the pie gets smaller, people tend to fight over the slices of the pie, and I'm really pleased to just hear how it's been such a collaborative process, both with citizens and staff and the labor unions. And so that's commendable, and I hope we can continue that as we can are going to have to continue to make really difficult choices over the next several months. I note former Mayor Blood Clark is here, and I want to recognize that he was instrumental during his tenure in looking at ways to provide money for maintenance of transportation through the cable and franchise fees. And so we are bringing a resolution or an ordinance next week, which is going to have some more revenue from an agreement with one of our providers, so that is still forefront in my mind that we need to have ongoing revenue for these basic services in all 95 neighborhoods. And so I'm pleased that we've got a plan for how to do that, and I will continue to work on the capital improvement side as well. Aye.
Leonard?
Well, I, too, very much respect the difficult position you're in, Sue and Mayor Adams, trying to provide probably one of the most critical and necessary services while being confounded with decreasing revenue. And I'd really like to talk about that just for a second. It is frustrating to me as a person who's interested in the subject of alternative fuels and efficiency to realize that because of the construction of the gas tax, local residents and providers of service end up getting punished when fuel-efficient vehicles roll out, when electric-powered vehicles roll out, hybrid vehicles roll out, because of the archaic way that we construct our gas tax as per gallon. I think that we have to, and I say the collective we, elected officials, be it in the Oregon legislature and here on the council, really need to demand something more thoughtful than a percent a gallon tax, whether that's a percentage tax a percentage of the price of gasoline or not, I'm not sure. But at minimum, it's really frustrating to me watch, you know, basically the price of gas at a pump swing 25 cents a gallon one way or the other, and residents don't pay much attention to that, whereas if we had a 25 cent a gallon increase in the gas tax, think of all the work that can be done in Oregon to not just improve the existing infrastructure, but to do some really vital replacement work like the Selwood Bridge and other vital transportation elements. I mean, at a minimum, it seems to me, if they don't want to, as a legislature, get in and reconfigure how we raise funds through some more thoughtful means than a kind of a per diem amount per gallon of gas, that we would at least raise the tax 25 cents a gallon. I mean, to not have that be the discussion, to not have leaders willing to go out and argue to the voters why that makes sense is very frustrating to me, to hear Sue come in and frame the argument basically in what we are left with when we lack the political will that's necessary in Salem to do what really needs to be done, and that's to raise the revenue somehow. So I hope that gets more and more attention. I know Governor Kulongoski has focused on that. I know Mayor Adams has focused on that, and I would do whatever I was asked to do to help in that effort. Thank you. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I'm pleased to support this policy, although it's not a pleasing thing to do. But to triage how we provide services and transportation, I just want to take this opportunity to commend both Mayor Adams and the Bureau of Transportation for their outstanding work during the December snowstorms. That was certainly an unprecedented storm, and your ability to keep people moving, whether it's on foot, didn't see too many bike riders, but transit and the roads, the arterials open, was really great work. So, aye.
Adams.
One of the first off, I want to acknowledge that this city Council and the members that were on it beforehand, but especially Commissioners Saltzman and Leonard, have been absolutely steadfast in their support of transportation and appreciate the support that Commissioners Fritz and Fish bring to the effort. It's a difficult task, there's no question about it. And Sue and John and the entire group of folks at transportation, I think, as someone told me during the snowstorm when I checked in with Spokane, they said, you know, Portland has so little money but does so much in terms of your transportation department. It is the best transportation department in the West, given the resources that you don't have. The other issue is we will be changing some communications with the public regarding this. We will be putting signs up on busy streets to advertise the 503-823 bump. We do want people to call in the potholes on the neighborhood streets. We'll be less proactive at it, so we really will be relying on the citizens to let us know when we need to respond off of the busiest streets. Aye. That gets us to item number 81.
Authorize a cooperative procurement with Pierce Manufacturing, Inc. for fire apparatus for a contractual total of $1,910,000.
Mr. Baer.
Good morning, Mayor Adams, City Council. For the record, I'm Jeff Baer with the Bureau of Purchases, and with me is Glenn Eisner from Portland Fire and Rescue. And we're here before you today to request permission to enter into a contract with Pierce Manufacturing through their local distributor, Hughes Fire and Equipment, out of Springfield, Oregon. And what this will allow us to do is to purchase a 95-foot rear-mount fire apparatus and a 105-foot mid-mount aerial apparatus for the total price of $1,910,000. And just some issues related to our policy, they are in full compliance with our equal benefit requirements and have current EEO certification. And just to kind of do just a quick background, the original ordinance that authorized this to was issued in 2007, and we've been working along with Portland Fire and Rescue to identify the best method to acquire these two pieces of equipment. And we've identified that the best one would be through this cooperative agreement through the Houston-Galveston Area Council of Governments. So with that, I'll stop, and if Glenn has any comments.
The apparatus we have, truck one, is 18 years old. It has over 80,000 miles, which is less than the 120,000 that we're currently going with. However, I'd point out it's a downtown truck, which means that the runs that it goes on has very low miles. So it is one of the most used trucks. If you ever see a greater alarm, it's but what we call a bucket, the platform where the firefighters operate, is always up at operation on that that fire. Last year, for example, we spent over $21,000 just repairing it. Truck two is 16 years old. It's a 1993 Tebow. It has over 104,000 miles on it. I'd also point out that even though that is less, it's also a training truck. And training means that instead of it being just in a ready mode at a fire station between calls, it is being used all day long by the trainees, and so it has significantly more wear and tear on it than we would normally expect. Both those trucks are due to be replaced. Truck two, we spent over $33,000 last year just repairing it. We have worked with the HGAC contract as Mr. Baer said, and we've been actually able to the price with that contract went up this year 8%, and we've been able to hold that cost, 4% I believe it was, and we've been able to hold that cost down with cooperation with Hughes Fire and Pierce Manufacturing through the end of this month, so we can save the city $80,000 on this.
And for the record, your name is?
Glenn Eisner.
Thank you. Questions from the council? Anything you'd like to close with?
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody signed up for this item?
No one signed up.
Anyone in the room wishes to testify on the apparatus issue?
Hello, my name is Cliff Hutchison. I'm just a citizen, precinct 4167, Southeast Portland. And just short before I go home, I'd just like to say that if there's a standard of mileage before we replace equipment, I think it's probably meaningful to keep it. The truck they mentioned that had only 80,000 miles on it, I don't understand why we'd want to replace that one. The one that has 104,000 is over the 100,000 mileage that was the old standard. It's maybe more reasonable to replace that one, even if it didn't reach 120,000 miles. But, I mean, what's the meaning of having a standard if we don't have to keep it, and especially when it's saving the taxpayer money, which would I appreciate that very much.
I appreciate that observation. Let me try to help you a little. The measurement of wear and tear, one is miles. Another is hours on an engine. And I think what Glenn probably didn't point out is that the hours on the engine are probably way above average, because when the trucks are stationary, they run the engines, obviously, to perform operations. And so I think the engine probably has run quite a bit more than what the miles would reflect.
Yeah, that's worth pointing out.
Yeah.
Then, so we all know that our money's being spent wisely. Fine. Thank you.
I'd like to point out, as I said, to reiterate, truck one is 18 years old, which is 6 years over the new 12-year standard. And truck two is 16 years old. It's over 4 years over the new 12-year standard.
But is it accurate that the engine hours are higher than what one would normally expect?
Absolutely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, we go into the engines to find out how the mileage versus the idling time. And typically when we go to an emergency, the rig sits at the emergency while the firefighters are doing their duty. Idling time is now 80% of the entire time of the engine. So just to say that it may have 80 or 100,000 miles does not mean that the wear and tear on the motor itself isn't significant.
Right.
And if I could just comment, Chief Eisner, that something I learned as the fire commissioner during my brief stint is that the maintenance of our equipment in the fire bureau is done in the fire bureau's own maintenance facility. And it's a unique situation where highly trained people maintain the equipment, and they have been charged with pushing the limit in terms of the useful life of our equipment. Yeah. And because we have our own highly skilled technicians, we've been able to do that. But what I have learned is that when even our people say it's time, it's time.
Sir, thank you for listening so carefully and paying attention to the details. I think that was a good question to raise.
It was.
The compelling part to me is that we spent $21,000 on maintenance last year, which if my vehicle was taking 20% of its replacement, taking that much for maintenance, I think I would be looking at, is it time to replace it? Thank you for helping us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Definitely helps restore, give us the confidence in the use of our money. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chief. Unless there's additional council discussion, Carla, will you please call the roll?
Fish?
Aye.
Fritz?
I commend Mayor Adams and Commissioner Leonard for having this on the regular agenda when we're spending $1.9 million of taxpayers' money. I think it was very helpful. The citizen was able to come forward and ask his questions and get skilled responses to it, and this is how we want to conduct the business of the city. Aye.
Leonard?
Thank you. Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams.
Aye. Item is approved. Would you please read the title for item 82?
Authorize an intergovernmental agreement between the City Housing Authority of Portland and Portland Development Commission relating to the development and operation of the Resource Access Center development.
Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. And we're going to invite Jeff Bachrach, the Chair of the Housing Authority of Portland, Andy Miller, Deputy Director of the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, and Mike Andrews, Project Manager for the Housing Authority of Portland, to make our initial presentation, but I have a few introductory remarks. This day has been a long time coming. The Resource Access Center is the next major piece of the city and county very innovative 10-year plan to end homelessness. This Resource Access Center, when built, will provide essential community services. It will promote respect for homeless staff and the surrounding community. It will replace the Gleason Street Men's Shelter, and it will add 130 units of vitally needed affordable housing, what we call permanent supportive housing, housing married with services that is desperately needed in our community. And as the council will recall, for citizens whose income is between 0 and 30% of median family income, and that means for a family of four, about $20,000, we have a shortage of about 11,000 units in our community. And for people who are at the absolute bottom of that income tree, who are suffering from addiction and mental illness and other challenges, we have a significant shortfall of units that serve this vulnerable population. Recently, during the severe winter weather emergency, this community rallied together like never before to save lives, to take homeless individuals and families off the streets and place them into our shelter system. But what we learned is we need more than a temporary solution. We need a long-term solution. And this Resource Access Center is a critical piece of our 10-year plan. Now, the council has continually supported the development of the Resource Access Center. And most recently, in March of last year, council made two critical determinations. The first, that Block U, which is bordered on one side by the bus station and the other by what is currently the post office, but which many of us hope someday will be the future world headquarters of Google, at the gateway to Broadway off of the Broadway Bridge, that Block U was the preferred site. And this council also directed the Housing Authority of Portland, the Portland Development Commission, and my bureau, the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, to develop an intergovernmental agreement to make this project a reality. Since that action by a former council, we have experienced a significant economic downturn, which has changed everything, including our assumptions about how we finance this Resource Access Center. And as the new housing commissioner, working with an incredibly talented group of people, I challenged them to take a fresh look at this and every other project in the pipeline and to answer the question, how can we deliver on the promise but also meet the challenges of this economy? And through that fresh look, I'm pleased to say that the development that is coming before you today for your approval at this stage is no longer a full block project. It is a half block project. It is no longer a 2 to 4 story building, but it is now a concrete base urban form building built to the highest standards as a gateway building to Broadway. And I want to just compliment Mike Andrews and our whole team for responding to the challenge that the collapse of our credit markets and the downturn of our economy presented. And to me, this is an example of where in every great challenge, there's an opportunity. And I believe that the development that is presented will be presented to you today for your consideration is better than what would have been presented to you in the fall of last year. My colleagues will be pleased to know that the Resource Access Center is shovel-ready. And whether it's funded out of TIF or out of the President's stimulus package, we're ready to build it. Importantly, it will create dozens of family wage jobs in the construction industry, which are desperately needed, which in turn will have an important multiplier in our local economy. And it will meet the highest standards of green building and energy conservation that our construction budget will allow. And we'll have more on that during the presentation. Today's ordinance, if approved, will move this project from concept to reality. Before introducing our panel, I'd like to thank a number of the individuals who have made an outstanding contribution to get us to this point. First, of course, Jeff Bachrach, who was just reelected to, I believe, his third term as HAP chair. Harriet Cormack, who's here. Harriet, if you would acknowledge yourself. Harriet is a HAP board member and a member of the RAC Community Advisory Committee, which she co-chaired with Mayor Bud Clark. Bud Clark, who we're going to be hearing from shortly, who I understand is a tavern owner. I'm told at some point in the past he was an arts aficionado, an arts supporter of some kind, and he is more to the point today. He is a member of the board of Transition Projects, Inc., which is going to have a vital place at the Resource Access Center. And with Harriet, he co-chaired the Community Advisory Committee. Mayor Clark, it's an honor to have you with us today, and we look forward to your testimony. Stephen Ying, if you could raise your hand, Mr. Ying, as you know, is the president of the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association and also a member of the Community Advisory Committee. And I think, as you will hear later, someone who has had a healthy and constructive level of skepticism at various stages of this project, which has helped us deliver a better product. Doreen Binder, the executive director of Transition Project, Inc. Doreen, if you would just raise your hand. At the Portland Development Commission, I want to acknowledge Comey Colivar, John Warner, Barbara Shaw, and in addition, I want to acknowledge the work of Kate Allen, who is the Housing Policy Coordinator for the City of Portland, Mike Andrews, Andy Miller, and so many more. So, gentlemen, if you could lead the presentation.
Commissioner Fish, thank you very much. Mayor Adams, council members, I am Jeff Backer, Chair of the Housing Authority, and have more of a symbolic than a substantive role in this project. As a couple of very brief comments before I turn over to Mike Andrews, who is the project manager. Just briefly by way of background, it was 18 months ago that former Mayor Potter and former Housing Commissioner Sten asked HAP to step in and take on this project as the lead developer. And we appreciated the confidence that assignment showed in HAP. We like to think it's based on our track record developing as a public developer these kinds of complicated mixed-use, mixed-income projects that try to serve a number of social housing goals, and RAC certainly fits that profile in all respects. For the last 18 months, HAP, under Mike's leadership in particular, has been working with a rich mixture of constituents, and nicknamed a lot of them, not just PDC and the city, who are signatories to the IGA today, but the county has a role, TPI has a role, community groups have a role. So it was a rich broth of folks to get us where the project is today. The next 8 months will be critical as we overcome sort of the final hurdles, get the financing in place, get the plans in place, get the permits in place, so this project can actually begin construction next fall. And I'm confident under Commissioner Fish's leadership and the same team that's been working for 18 months, we'll get this project ready to go in 8 more months. A lot of work left to be done, but we've reached a real milestone today with the IGA in front of the city and the expected approval tomorrow by PDC of the development agreement between HAP and PDC. So the pieces are in place. The team will get it done over the next 8 months. What I'll do at this point is turn it over to Mike Andrews, who can just briefly give you more of the details and the substance of where this project stands. But thanks to everyone involved in getting us this far. It's an important project, and I know HAP will help deliver it, beginning construction in 18 months and having a project ready to go in 2 years. Thank you. Mike Andrews.
Mr. Mayor, members of the commission, Commissioner Fish, thank you for your support and leadership on this. Thank you for your kind words. Andy Miller and I will walk through quickly a presentation on the Resource Access Center. We've had the opportunity to brief your offices, or in some cases yourselves, on this project. So we'll hit some high points, and we are available to answer any questions that you may have. I think you may have an opportunity to see in front of you this presentation. So this is the project ending schematic design that we're looking to build on the block U, which Commissioner Fish had identified. For reference, you can see the block here. It's bordered by Broadway and 6th, Hoyt and Irving, and you can see the site where there's strong interest in Google relocating. The development has three fundamental public imperatives: the 130 units of affordable rental housing, the Resource Access Center, which will provide resources to homeless individuals during the day, and replacing the 90-bed men's shelter which is currently operated by TPI. And TPI would be the lead operator of the Resource Access Center and continue to run the shelter. The housing will be permanent supportive housing. It will be targeted to folks who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. The Housing Authority will bring operating subsidy to all 130 of these units, making them both affordable to those individuals and providing operating funds for the housing. This project will also replace the 70 units currently located in the Grove Hotel when that building would ultimately come down, making way for a development which is planned on that site. We came to the plan, which you see before you, and have gone through this fresh look, as it was described, as part of a community process, a community advisory committee that was co-chaired by Bud Clark and Harry Cormack, met five times. They focused on the design, the architecture, the urban design. They focused on the housing program. When the full impact of the financial market collapse was realized, we went back to that community advisory committee and shared with them the redesign of the building to keep faith with that initial process that we did go through with them. At the suggestion of Commissioner Fritz, we had the opportunity Monday evening to brief the residents of the Gleason Street shelter. So our design team and folks from TPI presented the plans to them, and we received positive feedback and good questions and comments from them. So it was a very transparent process. We feel good about the leadership that Harry Cormack and Bud Clark brought to that. In total, it is an eight-story concrete building that will sit on the western edge of this block. It is a very visible block, so we have paid great attention to the design, to the aesthetic of the building. In addition to providing important housing and services, we also pay attention to what we're building and how we build it. We are pursuing LEED Gold certification. We are looking at innovative techniques such as gray water recapture. So the water that will come from sinks and toilets would be cleansed and being able to reuse to flush toilets, from sinks to be able to use to flush toilets. We also focus a lot on what the Housing Authority calls economic participation. This is making sure that certified businesses, minority women-owned businesses, and low-income people have an opportunity to work on this project, and it will create a significant number of construction jobs. We're also focused on public art and have reached out to both the other RAC, the Regional Art Council, and PNCA, who will be located across the street in the 511 building once that project is completed, to get their participation and support on the development of the art aspect of this building. With that, I'll turn it over to Andy, who will walk through a little bit more of the operations of the shelter and the RAC itself.
Actually, I think you've got one more, the development.
Pardon me. The total project cost for this project is $45.9 million. The significant portion of that is $29.5 million that comes from tax increment financing from the what we expect to be settled, amended River District urban renewal area. We also are expecting to raise just over $9 million from the sale of a federal low-income housing tax credit. And the Housing Authority will invest $6.5 million of our cash in the development of this project. There's a small piece of miscellaneous resources as well, state resources, state tax credits, that we also will bring to bear. The project is currently fully funded. We believe that we've got adequate reserves to get us through the design and bidding phase and build the building that is expected.
Mike, just on the point on this slide, you mentioned the appeal, the challenge to the expansion of the River District Urban Renewal District. So just so that people watching this understand, by virtue of a challenge to the expansion of that district, which is currently before LUBA, we've been advised that it places a cloud over the city's ability to move on a number of projects. So as when that is resolved, either by a final decision by a tribunal or through some other means, that cloud will be removed, and a number of projects, including this, would proceed with tax increment financing dollars. But as I mentioned in my opening, we've also parked this project as a city priority for any federal stimulus dollars that we may get. And the other thing I just wanted to advise my colleagues is that where it says low-income housing tax credits, this has been a traditional tool that we've used to provide private resources to do these kinds of developments. Prior to the collapse of the credit markets, we were getting between 90 and 100 cents on the dollar of tax credit. So that tells you the value to a developer. We're told that currently the bottom of the market might be as little as 60 cents. So when you think about that as how that impacts your ability to finance one of these kinds of developments, the incredible collapse of our credit markets impacts us when we use this tool. But I am told by Senator Wyden that Congress is considering, as part of the stimulus package, allowing jurisdictions, which would include Portland, to simply convert the tax credits to dollars. Hmm. So, in other words, you'd be able to exchange them for some agreed-upon figure, 80 cents on the dollar, 85. But that would be one way of meeting both the stimulus goals and taking some of the uncertainty that the market has brought to bear. Hmm. So those are moving pieces. Thanks, Mike.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. I'm Andy Miller from the City's Bureau of Housing and Community Development. Before I start and move on in the presentation, I just want to acknowledge Will White, the director of BHCD, is not here today. He is actually in Washington, D.C., working to support passage of the stimulus package and working with our national partners on the types of legislative pieces that Commissioner Fish just referenced. So picking up where Mike left off, one of the major questions of this project from the beginning that you and others have had is will this be another WAPEDO? Are we building a facility that we will not be able to afford to operate? And I'm here to say emphatically that the answer is no. What you see before you is a layout of the proposed operating budget for the Resource Access Center, all three components, compared to, in the black column, the dollars that BHCD already has in its budget going to these activities. Those are the dollars that will transfer over into the Resource Access Center. So we already have in our budget, in an ongoing form, over half of what we will need to operate the Resource Access Center. And just important to note that those dollars are ongoing dollars and would not be affected by any of the proposed budget cuts that BHCD has submitted to OMF through the current budget process. So those are surviving dollars. At the bottom of this chart, you will see the in green, really the range of the gap that we're currently facing and have to fill over the next 18 months. So what will these operating dollars pay for? In short, the dollars will pay for the outcomes that the center, shelter, and housing will provide. And these are very impressive. They're in front of you in terms of the number of people who will pass through the center each day, reside in the shelter on a nightly basis, and move into the permanent housing. Really, there are two primary cost drivers. One are the salaries. So this also is a jobs creation piece in the social service sector. There are the salaries of the case managers and others who will work with the residents, work with the people who are coming into the center, and work with the residents of the shelter. The other is the simple increased cost of operating a more expanded space. This space is many times the size of what TPI currently operates as a relatively cramped community services center that allows us to serve more people, serve them in a more dignified way, and offer a much higher array of community services. We've already begun to strategize how we're going to meet the gap. We will use the next 12 months working with our partners to develop and realign resources to meet the operating needs of the new Resource Access Center. We've already started to take a very hard look at our current budget for homeless services across the system and have many creative ideas that we'll be working to implement in the next 12 months to realign existing community services to help meet this gap. We're going to look for every possible dollar through foundations, grant makers, our government partners, our community partners, work to realign the system and really turn over every rock before we come back to City Council to ask for any amount that would be needed to fill the ultimate operating gap on opening day.
A little bit about the status of the project. As has been said, we're heading towards a construction start in October of this year. We anticipate sending you all invitations to a groundbreaking that will probably occur in September. And the construction duration will have the building opened in April of 2011. So we have a lot of folks that are focused on design, construction, and financial matters, as well as property management and service provision. There's a large team of people who have been working on this project for quite some time. Over the next 9 months, we'll get through the city's design review process. We'll settle with our financial partners. We will bid this project. It's maybe as relates to the economic stimulus, it's important to point out it's just a prevailed project. We will be paying commercial prevailing wages on this project. So that will be very good paying construction jobs that will be created. And then again, in April of 2011, we're projecting that the building will open. Commissioner Fish asked us to identify five of the challenges that this project team is focused on. The River District LUBA appeal is one that has been discussed already. We are proceeding under the assumption that the appeal amendment will be settled, or that an alternative source of funds will be available, allowing us to proceed on the schedule we've identified. Commissioner Fish also talked about the tax credit market. There has been a significant, unprecedented change in that market. We are fortunate, however, that the Housing Authority has good relationships with tax credit investors. Right now, they're looking for project elements that this project and HAP as a developer can bring: a strong balance sheet, strong local support. There is no permanent debt on this project, so there's no foreclosure risk. It's in what's perceived as a strong city. So there are many things about this project that make it attractive to an investor. One small technical aspect that we're working with our colleagues at the county on is relates to an easement. You may have noticed that this building will sit next to the Broadway Bridge. So we're working with the county staff to adjust an existing easement that goes back to, I believe, 1930, that would allow the building to sit on its current footprint. And we've been working with the facilities and legal staff at the county to modify that easement so that the building can reside on its current anticipated footprint.
By the way, Chair Wheeler has graciously agreed to release the lien if we fully fund Hooper Detox for the next 10 years. And I've told him that that's certainly an opening. We understand it's an opening offer, and we will negotiate in good faith.
He's clearly learning.
Too quickly.
So we know that securing the appropriate level of operating resources is going to be a challenge, particularly in these down budget years that the city is facing. And what you have is our pledge to look system-wide, work every strategy, work with our service providers to see how we can move services into the rack and use this building as a launch pad for new efficiencies in the homeless system. And then the final challenge is really, it's an access center, and the community has asked access to what? Is this a shiny new bridge to nowhere? And I think really the project, our challenge is really going to be going forward to remind ourselves that this project alone will not end homelessness. Maintaining the safety net, maintaining the balance of the wonderful services that this council has generously supported over the last several budget cycles will continue to be necessary if we're going to be effective.
I have a question. Is it possible, given the challenges to operating, to open it in phases? As if you don't get as much operating revenue cobbled together as you need, sort of what sort of options do you have?
I think there already is a plan to open it in phases that has more to do with the development budget. But specifically to your question, there is a flexible array of services. There's a flexible array of operating hours. Our ambition is to expand the operating hours to a 7-day-a-week facility. If we don't find budget for that, we would reduce the hours that the center is available to folks.
And then you said that the buildings will sit on the west side of the property. Is that right?
That is correct.
So right next to the ramp?
That is correct.
Okay. Yes. Thanks. Other questions?
By the way, Mayor, just on that point, in going to a half-block urban form building, we have freed up the other half block, which has substantial value, and that's the block that is on the east side, faces the train station. And the IGA contemplates over the next 3 years that the Portland Development Commission and the City Council would have a discussion about how best to use that site. It would be, in the short term, used to stage some construction activity, but it presents an incredible opportunity, and that would not have been available had we obviously stayed with a full block plan.
So the entrance to the building is on the ramp side, is that right?
There are three entrances.
Okay. Why don't you put the slide up and show them?
Yeah.
So you're looking from the northwest now down onto the site. The entrance to the Resource Access Center itself is on the northern elevation of the building, and you can see it there behind these small trees. The entrance to the shelter is located on Broadway just before the ramp begins to come up, and the entrance to the housing is on the southern elevation of the building. So each of the three components have their own discrete entrance, and that goes to both the security and the flow of people through the building. So a lot of attention has been paid to how people come and go from this building, how the building is serviced from a maintenance and utility perspective, and how staff come and go.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Yes. I guess I'm concerned when I hear statements about the the building will strive for a very high environmental goal subject to the budget, because usually the green building features are often the first things axed. So I want some assurance here. We have a city policy that requires any project such as this that receives tax increment funding to meet at least the LEED Silver certification and be independently certified to that effect.
We are pursuing LEED Gold, and the current status of the project is we have schematic design that has been priced by our contractor that assumes in that pricing betterments that would allow us to achieve LEED Gold.
You say pursuing LEED Gold, I guess I want satisfaction that if you don't achieve LEED Gold, you will achieve LEED Silver.
I believe that LEED Silver is very attainable. We're pursuing LEED Gold, and I think we can provide
you just, promise that it'll be LEED Silver?
Yes, and independently certified to that effect?
I work with Commissioner Saltzman a lot, and he wants to hear, I promise, it'll at least be.
And Mike looks at me. Well, that's certainly the promise we can make here today, and if budget issues force us to reconsider it, we wouldn't do that until we came back and discuss with you.
But let me pick up the...
Let me throw it to even a higher authority, Commissioner Fish.
When we went through this process, we challenged your team to make this the greenest public building in Portland. Now, for this at Gold, for this kind of use, would be the greenest building in America for affordable housing. You've been challenged. I expect, as the housing commissioner, for us to meet the LEED Gold standard. But I believe we can safely say to Commissioner Saltzman that it will in no instance fall below LEED Silver. But because the bar keeps getting set higher in this community, we have challenged ourselves to get to LEED Gold. And yeah, you have my commitment as the housing commissioner and that we will meet the challenge.
Right.
And as you can look to the housing authority's track record, our last two multifamily buildings or mixed-use buildings have achieved LEED Gold. Humboldt Gardens, multifamily building.
I'm very impressed with your track record. Like I said, I'm just a little wary when I hear we're going to meet it subject to budget. That's always the catchphrase that often can mean the end of the green features. So I'm satisfied with the certifications made here today that it will be at least LEED Silver and independently certified to that effect. I'm very happy.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for our panel? All right, thanks.
Mayor, we have one more panel that's going to briefly testify. I'd like to call them up. First, Mayor Bud Clark, Stephen Yee, and Dorian Binder. And if you could each take a couple of minutes, and then we'll see if there are questions from council. And thank you for joining us today. Mayor Clark?
Oh, thank you. That wonderful introduction and the display. I don't know why we need to testify here, but I'm glad to be here. It's good to see that the buildings that I think we started 20 years ago is going to be replaced, because it was a difficult building when we took it over. And now 20 years later, we're going to have a much better facility that will provide our needs much, much better. So Mayor and City Council and ladies and gentlemen now, that's good. We've got a mixed group here now. As a member, I'm on the Transition Projects Board, and I'd like to emphasize the importance of this project to the people we serve and the importance of continuing the momentum to get the new center built as soon as possible. Our cramped community service center at the Gleason Street facility may serve up to 500 people per day, yet the need surpasses that number. The larger facility designed at the Resource Center Access Center will allow us to double the number of homeless people served. And as co-chair of the Community Advisor Committee with Mrs. Cormack and myself and Stephen Yang and others, I'd like to acknowledge the active participation of many community members, ranging from Transition Board climate clients to the Portland Business Alliance, service providers, and neighborhood representatives. Through a series of advisory committee meetings and half-day design workshops, the design team, led by the Housing Authority of Portland and Holst Architecture, presented alternatives and incorporated key concerns about technical design, architectural design, and the building operations that they heard from participants. At a recent design workshop held earlier this week for current shelter residents, the overall design was enthusiastically supported. Much more interest was placed on the need for jobs and housing opportunities as quickly as possible. Although the current economic crisis has led us to a more condensed half-block design, I'm looking forward to construction of the new facility with a grand opening celebration early in 2011. I hope you vote for this.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mayor, Commissioner, good morning. My name is Stephen Ying. As a longtime advocate for the Chinese community in Old Town Chinatown neighborhood, I have been pleased to serve as a member of the Community Advisory Committee for this project. After the Block U site was selected,